From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a big recovery operation in Oso, Washington, in its sixth day today after a huge mudslide buried much of the town. 25 people have been confirmed dead. 90 are still missing, maybe more. The scale and speed of the mudslide was stupefying. A great ridge turned to slurry, taking everything in its path. This is geology in motion, rapid motion. This hour On Point, mudslide science and the risks beyond Oso, Washington. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you see how a huge mountain turns to mush? Have you lived through it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's review. It all happened last Saturday morning. Paul Falco was driving down the road. He told Como TV, suddenly, as he drove, there was mud everywhere.
I just saw the darkness. That's all I could see. Everything from one side, completely in the other side.
A wall of mud. Survivor Robin Youngblood was in her home with a friend when a 25-foot wall of mud burst through her living room wall. She talked with CBS News about what happened next.
We were moving. We were underwater, under mud. We had mud in our hair, eyes, nose, mouth. Nothing was stable enough to stand on, so I just kept yelling at her to dig herself out, even if it hurt.
There wasn't much time, but the 911 calls came pouring in.
There's like a mudslide and everything's gone. The houses are gone.
Are there any injuries?
Yes, there's people yelling for help.
And then the days of looking. Among the missing, 36-year-old Summer Raffo, her brother Dan Bruner, told NBC the mission Tuesday was to find closure.
I'm going to search for my sister, to look for my sister. We want to bring her home. My mom wants to hold her one last time, and I'm going to make sure that that happens. It's not easy, and it's such a vast expanse of ground and land and stuff. There's so many places that she could be and so many places that her car could be, and we have no idea.
And the recovery goes on. Joining me first today from Marysville, Snohomish County, just southwest of Oso in Washington State, is Tom Bonzi. He's a reporter for Northwest News Network. Tom, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
So how many people are still out there working on this enormous mudslide site, Tom?
It's now day six of the search and for the really in large part now recovery mission. There are more than 200 searchers, professionals, and a few volunteers, including, like you just heard, relatives of victims that are, again, fanning out here starting at daybreak over this massive debris field. And they're bringing every imaginable tool to bear, including helicopters with thermal imaging sensors. I've seen hovercraft skittering around. They're earth movers now, chainsaws, a lot of loggers in the immediate area that have helpful skills with that, electronic sniffers. But really, more than anything, it's just the most basic search dogs, cadaver dogs, sniffing, and people with shovels and digging with their hands.
Tom, what's the debris field like at this point? Is it stable? Is it still moving? Is it wet? Is it dry?
It's not still moving, thankfully. I heard from one National Guardsman yesterday who compared the general conditions to working in wet concrete that hasn't quite set yet. It's been raining off and on for the last 3 days, and this mudslide went through a river before it fanned out across the small rural neighborhood. So it's still full of water, and there's new water on top of it. It's also very slippery, very hard conditions, according to the searchers.
We've seen the aerial photos, the photos on the ground, this huge piece of the hill, ridge, mountain, whatever you call it, that gave way here, and a river's involved. Where is that river now, and where's the water running or accumulating, Tom?
Well, when that landslide came down, it created a natural dam at first, backed up the still Guamish River behind it, and there are more homes that weren't hit by the debris field that are now flooded. Gradually, as that lake rose, it overtopped the debris field, and it has been, for the last 5 days, starting to cut a natural channel back down through that very soft mud and clay. And there's still a flash flood watch downstream mm-hmm. of that natural dam, but the risk is pretty low to the extent that the media briefing area is now in the floodplain about 10 miles south of, or I should say again, west of this, and we're not terribly worried about me being hit. That the flood risk which came with this has diminished. That's one sliver of good news.
But the scale here is just overwhelming. We're talking miles when you talk about risk. 49 homes, structures in the immediate path of the mudslide. What happened to most of those? Were they crushed? Are they still standing? Are they under mud but somehow intact?
Well, what seems to have happened is that they were just hit with a wall of mud and water and just pushed across the landscape. So most of the searching is happening at the perimeter, at the leading edge, a mile from where this started, where everything's kind of been accumulated. But you can imagine, the best analogy I can make, and this is just applying kind of your common sense to what you see in front, that it was like being in a washing machine with rocks and logs being tumbled for half a mile. And because even cars, big solid SUV, it's just totally mangled and, in 8 different pieces when you find it there at the all tumbled together at the front edge.
And 90 still missing. Are most of those assumed to be under the mud somewhere at this point?
Somewhere. And that number, which has fluctuated at very first days, it was 18 people maybe unaccounted for, 2 dead. Then the unaccounted missing number went to 108 until a day ago it was at 176. Now the latest word and a more credible number is 90 people missing. And that, when that number came out and some more weight was attached to it, but the missing persons detectives had already gone through it, that then the enormity of the loss facing this community and the state is sinking in. Most of those people are feared dead now. It's too much time has passed.
Yeah. Tom, speak to us about the officials there in Snohomish County and the people who live there. I mean, do the officials feel guilty that they let people build and live there? Do the one-time residents of Oso, the survivors, feel, what the heck were we thinking? Why were we there?
The answer to that, in short, is yes and no. I mean, the really hard questions are being asked now, and they should be asked, because it is true this landslide risk was well known. That exact slope gave way in 2006 and then several other times in earlier decades in our lifetime. So it was clearly labeled as landslide prone on geologic maps, which unfortunately, though, and we can talk about this more in this hour, are not very easy for the layperson to make sense of. So the people there knew there was risk, but when I say yes and no, the no part of that is no one locally, at least, or in the county government, says they anticipated a slide of this magnitude, and no one was prepared for that.
Tom Bonsi with Northwest News Network, not far from Oso, Washington. Tom, thank you very much for being with us today. Be safe. Be careful.
Thank you.
In a press conference in Seattle over the weekend, the county fire chief, Travis Hotz, described the scope of the devastation.
The mud and debris has fallen and created a huge area out there. In fact, you pull up to it, and it's as far as I could see around the corner from my vantage point here on the west side. I was at awe. I've never seen anything like it in my 20-year fire service career.
We want to get a sense of what it's really like out there on the slide, on the mud. Ted Warren is with us from Darrington, Washington, right next door to Oso, staff photographer for the Associated Press. Print reporters, other reporters, not allowed really into the scene of the debris itself, but photographers, yes. Ted has taken really compelling pictures. Big aerial photo of his led the New York Times page 1 yesterday, and also right down on the ground. Ted Warren, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Describe for us what it's been like out on this debris field, actually trying to move around on it, Ted.
Well, when we were brought in, we were brought to the end of Highway 530 from Arlington, and so we were not allowed to get actually on the debris field, but we were watching workers with heavy equipment trying to move these big, objects as big as entire trees. Other times they were trying with their buckets to scoop up mud and kind of slurry that just seemed to slosh out before they could move half of it. And there were also individual citizens who were very carefully trying to make their way on top of a house that had been destroyed and came to rest on the road. But just at the edge of where we were, you could see the mud, and in some of my wide-angle pictures from that It almost looks like it's still moving. It's just you can see how squishy and slushy it is. And if you take one step off the pavement, even onto the grass, you can still feel how the ground is saturated.
We're talking millions of cubic yards. Hovercraft, what kind of equipment have they brought in to try and move around and work on this, Ted?
I have seen a huge variety of equipment. I have seen the hovercraft boats, and I would imagine those would work on the flooded areas where the water is smooth. Mm-hmm. I saw one of the biggest bulldozers that I've ever seen go through the roadblock on this side of the slide yesterday. It had a massive blade. I've seen front loaders, track hoes, and I've seen small bobcat-type vehicles also. I do know from what I've seen and talking to colleagues that they, while the effort is very intense, they're very methodical and very careful, and even with the heavy equipment, moving things and then looking. And
I mean, they have to. I'm reading here a logger from the town where you are now describing, tragically, body parts sticking out of the mud, human parts.
Yes, and fortunately, we weren't witness to any of that from what we saw, but I do believe that they're lifting up a load, they spread it out, they look at it, and they're looking for any signs that there may be a victim nearby, and they're being very careful and very methodical, and it's worth noting that most of the volunteers that they've called for and most of the people with logging equipment, these are local people. These are people who know the people who are
who may be under there. Incredible scale of disaster, mudslide in Oso, Washington. Ted Warren has photographed it compellingly for the Associated Press. He joined us from, well, he's been right next to the mud. Ted, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, the sound of helicopter there over Oso, Washington, and the huge of Saturday's enormous mudslide. We're looking at that mudslide in Washington State, looking at geology in motion, mudslide science, and the risks beyond little Oso and its big mudslide this hour. Early in the week, it was searching for survivors. Here was Snohomish County Fire Chief Tavis Hotz describing the painstaking, delicate search process.
When the dogs get a hit in an area, in some cases, we utilize sophisticated electronic equipment like cameras that can get down into void spaces and look. And they'll usually do that first and utilize listening devices. Then we get teams in there and they're removing stuff with their hands if they can.
By hand, in an area of millions and millions of square cubic yards of slurry, of debris. Could we have done something about it early in the week? Here was John Pennington, director of Snohomish County Emergency Management, saying homeowners were aware of the slide potential.
There's been warnings and advance notifications of the high risk for landslides. We've done everything we could. My heart goes out to all of these individuals. We're going to get to the bottom of this.
But was it enough? Yesterday, a little different tone as the full scale of this came really into a clearer perspective for John Pennington and everybody else. Here he is again yesterday.
The FEMA and state teams that are here are doing an incredible job. But I think we need to take a step back, guys, and look at the magnitude of what happened. The debris field is huge. It is complex. It is dangerous. And I don't think we have a lot of answers.
We want to look at mudslide science and the risks in Oso and well beyond. David Montgomery joins us right now from Seattle, Washington. He's a geologist, professor of earth and space sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. David Montgomery, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Don.
The magnitude of this looks incredible when you put it up against a little town, a tiny town like Oso. But what about the magnitude of this slide when you put it up against other slides that take place, I don't know, year in and year out in the United States?
You know, landslides come in all sizes, and there's lots of different varieties of types of slides. And this tragic one is an example of one that moved very rapidly. If you look at the laser altimetry data, even within that same valley, though, there's evidence for even larger ancient landslides. How old, we don't know at this point. But this is a really tragic example of how an entire hillside can collapse, liquefy, move rapidly across a valley bottom, and behave in a way that most people would find utterly unimaginable looking at a hillside on a day when it's perfectly stable. Now, that slide was known to have occurred well, it had failed in the past many times, actually. But the one that went this time was actually far bigger, went a lot farther than ones that had happened there previously. So the idea that the slope may have been safe to live under is, you know, in hindsight, tragically, obviously false. But could the people living there have actually had the conception of the magnitude of the kind of disaster when they heard the words landslide risk? There's a need to communicate to the general public what geologists know about the potential for failures like that. And this was a particular dangerous hillside.
Okay, we're listening now, I guess. David, take us, if you would, into that ridge. And you're the geologist. Take us inside, paint a picture for us of what was going on in there when it just, you know, from this on the surface, perhaps just looked like a lovely slope in Washington.
Yeah, well, let's start with the geologic history briefly of that particular slope, because it was so dangerous because of the legacy of glaciation that we have in western Washington. This is a very dynamic, active geologic landscape, and the landscape is actually still recovering from, still evolving from the melt-off of the last ice advance down into the Puget Lowland, the area around Seattle that this is on the margin of. And at the base of that slope, there are pre-glacial deposits, the river deposits, I believe, that predate the last glaciation. And then if you go up through, working through the stratigraphy, the structure, the deposits that are actually in that slope, at the base, as I understand it, there's lake sediments that were laid down in front of an advancing ice sheet, and then the upper part of the slope was mostly sand and fine material that was laid down by the rivers, the streams that were melting out of that glacier. So sort of a pile of clay on the bottom with sandier and silt material higher up on the slope.
Does that mean it's built to slide in some way?
In effect, yes, because the sand, the material on top is very porous. So the water that would fall in the rain, and in the Northwest we get plenty of that, would seep down through that slope, hit the clay layer at the bottom, and it can't go any further. I mean, we use clay to essentially line toxic waste dumps,
sure,
because it doesn't allow water to go through. Mm-hmm. So you have essentially a deposit that could get accumulate water. The pressures within the void spaces but in that material would go up with more rainfall. The water would flow laterally above the clay, and you'd have a seepage face on the valley wall.
So in a sense, I mean, not only is it turning to slurry, but the whole mass is almost floating on a lake accumulating on this clay beneath.
Well, in a way, not quite floating, what happens as the water fills the void spaces within the deposit, the water pressure goes up. That reduces the normal force that's holding the slope together. It actually does add a buoyant force. Doesn't quite float it off, but it reduces the strength.
Mm-hmm.
And as the strength is reduced, that can initiate failure. The next step is sort of the critical one in terms of understanding why this thing would surge so fast across the valley bottom. And that is, if you have a bunch of sand, imagine a bunch of billiard balls, say, with void spaces in between it. Those void spaces are filled with water.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very loose. These deposits were not overrun by a glacier. It's fairly loose surface sediment. And once it starts to collapse and those pieces start to jostle and move, the void space in between that's full of water is getting compressed, and that raises the water pressure further can cause liquefaction of the slope.
Mm-hmm.
And so once it starts to fail, you get a positive feedback where it can accelerate and then surge laterally across the valley bottom. The particular kind of material contributed greatly to it.
I want to ask about that collapse, if I may, David.
Yeah.
So many questions here. But here's something that really caught our ear on NPR. This was – you may have heard this. This was Doug Dix. And on Saturday, when all this suddenly happened, he was in his barn listening to music, and suddenly this mile-and-a-half-wide river of mud, the collapse you describe, was heading toward him. And listen how he describes the screeching sound that it made as it moved.
It sounded like a double-twin Huey with the engine – being torn into shrapnel. I honestly thought one was crashing, and I'm up looking for the explosion.
Can you describe the physics of 15 million square yards of debris and mud and you name it moving down the hillside? What's the sound that comes out of that? What makes the sound?
Well, all the pieces jostling with each other, banging into each other. I mean, the analogy we heard earlier of a mixing machine essentially with a lot of sand and then the debris within it, the trees, the material from the river that was presumably scooped up as well, and then tragically on the far end, all the houses. And the pieces of them are essentially being mixed up and banged together. It's a lot of energy. Imagine the energy of inherent in that mass sitting on the hillside being translated into motion, yeah. And then those particles exerting that force on each other as they move. It's an unimaginable amount of force involved.
Here's Darrington firefighter. This was Janet McClellan, one of the rescue workers first at the site, talking with King 5 News yesterday about exactly that scene.
Everywhere around us was debris. There was clay, there was big rocks, loads of trees. I mean, huge timber, you know, like you see around here. You look at the way the debris is, there can be pockets, and we live for that hope. We really live for that hope.
Like a washing machine full of rocks and logs, trees, says my guest, David Montgomery. David, lots of questions for you. Dennis in Bloomington, Illinois. Dennis, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I have a geology degree, and I've been kind of following this story as it's developed. Looking at the pictures and photos that the media has presented, it appears that there was a clear-cutting area immediately within the area of the landslide. My question was...
Yeah, we can kind of see that in this. I'm looking at a picture here from the air, and just at the back of the at the back edge of the slide, you can see that it apparently was logged right behind that, Dennis.
Yeah, exactly. And my question is, was the area allowed to be logged after the geological survey had already presented the area as a landslide possible area?
And might that have contributed to its instability, yeah. I guess? David Montgomery?
Exactly.
Well, it's my understanding that the clear cut that is at the top of the slope where it's failed now was cut prior to the previous failure in 2006, and that was actually back from the edge of that. But whether those are connected is something I think that will be looked into. The conceivable connection there between the prior failure and that clear cut would be through the degree to which that changed the water balance within the slope. You can imagine trees evapotranspirate a lot of water. Any water that they would have been taking up would not have made it down to the groundwater table. So the connection between logging practices and the potential for slope instability for this kind of a failure in this place is probably through the water balance. I don't know enough about the history of logging up in the water recharge area of this particular slides, but the instability at that particular site that failed again this time was known in terms of its geological instability before I think any of the logging that you could see on the landscape today. Because the knowledge of that instability goes back, you know, to the 1960s or so. The science behind understanding the role of logging and water recharge areas for slides like this is inexact in the sense that we know that there can be a connection, but how much of a connection is uncertain. There was a study, though, done back, you know, I think it was published in 1998, of the role of groundwater recharge from potential timber harvest in the groundwater recharge area of that particular slope.
Yep.
That was done by a geomorphologist named Dan Miller and his co-author on the academic study was Joan Cias, and they also they had some other reports on that slope. The connection between that kind of activity and this current failure is something I'm sure is going to be looked into. I can't give you an opinion at this point as to whether I think it was definitely connected or not. It's not a terribly large clear cut, whether it was actually in the wrong place at the wrong time and how that relates to the timing of the slide is something that certainly deserves an awful lot of attention. Those questions need to be asked, but I can't give you an answer now.
That geologist, Daniel Miller, who warned in 1999 about the potential for a large catastrophic failure of this hillside, will join us here in just a few minutes. Dennis, good question from Bloomington, Illinois. Another question that comes up, David Montgomery, on the morning of the slide, this vast giving way, there was a small earthquake not so far from this site. Might that have shaken this loose?
You know, it's my understanding that earthquake was a magnitude 1 or so. That was a very, very small earthquake. And while that could have, you know, somehow altered the hill slope. It's a small enough earthquake that I really doubt that that there was a contributing factor to it. But what you'd really want to know is how shallow was the earthquake. I actually don't know that at present. But I don't think that that's actually a likely contributing factor. I'd actually be much more suspicious about the role of the river at the toe of the slope cutting into the slide, because one of the things that Dan Miller's paper illustrated very well was that that slope was very sensitive to the removal of material at the bottom of the slope. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a very well-known causal mechanism for slope instability is to undermine the toe of a slope. That slope was prone to it with a river cutting into the toe of it. Efforts were taken to actually to keep the river from cutting into the toe of that slope back in 2007 after the last slide off of that slope.
Yes.
To what degree that revetment was still functioning this winter, I actually don't know yet.
Let's go to Frank in Niagara Falls. Everybody's thinking about those homes that were just sitting there in the path of this. Frank in Niagara Falls, thanks for joining us. You're on the air, Frank.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes. I was a resident of Western Washington for 15 years.
Out in this area? This is 50 miles or so north of Seattle, or where, Frank?
I was primarily in the SeaTac area and out in the islands.
Seattle, Tacoma, yeah.
Island.
Yeah.
However, I do have relatives in the northern, northwestern area. I think having had that residency, and this was, I don't want to narrow it down any more than to say it was between the administrations of Dixie Lee Ray and Gary Locke.
Former governor there, yeah.
And so this was some time ago. However, it seems to me that, and it may be too soon to say this, but it seems to me that we really need to have some criminal investigation of the permitting authorities and so forth in this area. I have experienced, when I was in Washington during those times, I thought it was highly corrupt politically. And insidiously so, because it was not, it was very well covered up.
Frank, our time is short before the break, but let us pick it up right there. David Montgomery, I know you're not an attorney, but you're a geologist, and you know what's going on under there. You know how obvious or subtle the risk, the threat may have been here. I mean, our caller takes it all the way to, you know, let's have a criminal investigation of permitting authorities. As a geologist, does it look to you that this was such an obvious, flagrant threat, risk, that there should not have been building there?
Well, in hindsight, the answer is obvious to that. This is an absolutely terrible place to allow people to build. But, could you have foreseen that that slope would have gone all the way across the valley bottom? Well, yes, I think that is the kind of thing that Dan Miller was worrying about
in 1999.
Terms of seeing, in 1999, worrying about how potentially unstable that slope was. In the experience of people hearing that there's a potential for catastrophic failure, I think there's a gulf between translating that warning into an understanding of just how big the hazard really was. And if you look at the hazard maps for that particular site, they would have shown that the properties that were destroyed were at risk for flood hazards. They were in the floodplain on the opposite side of the river from the hillside.
Yep.
And a geologist can connect those dots and go, oh, well, that hillside might come out and run out over across the entire valley bottom. But people who are not trained geologically or not geomorphologists to understand how to read the landscape don't necessarily have the tools that it takes to put that together.
I guess we sort of count on our officials and developers to talk with geologists. After all, we all build on geology.
Yes, and it's that role of connecting the dots between hazard, where people want to live, and how the earth actually works that is really so tragically highlighted in this case.
David Montgomery, please stand by in Seattle. Forgive me, but we have to take a short break right here. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the big mudslide in Washington State, looking at geology in motion, mudslide science, and the risks beyond Little Oso and its very big slide. In the early days, it was Neighbors who were looking around trying to help one another here on Monday was Elaine Young. Her home sits at the edge of this vast mudslide, describing how local residents organized a search party.
We went over to the debris yesterday afternoon, and we stayed back from the river stuff, but unfortunately, we uncovered bodies and had to contact authorities to try and get somebody to come down and remove them.
25 confirmed dead, 90 still missing. Yesterday, Snohomish County Emergency Management Director John Pennington said that millions of dollars were spent after a much smaller 2006 landslide to prevent a repeat.
In 2006, there was the original slide. We all now know that. It was a pretty decent-sized slide that impacted the community, flooded it pretty good. There was a lot of mitigation effort that went into that river after that fact, and I'm talking about millions of dollars worth of work.
But he was shaken, broke down in tears at one point during the media briefing yesterday. And here's Pennington saying that people who lived in the path of Saturday's massive mudslide, quote, knew the risk, and that sometimes catastrophes, quote, just happen.
Sometimes big events just happen. Sometimes large events that nobody sees happens. And this event happened. And I want to find out why. I want to understand why. I want to understand the dynamic of a potential small earthquake behind it that shook it loose. And I don't have those answers right now.
We're going to hear in 1 minute from the man who warned of this in 1999, Daniel Miller. David Montgomery is with us from the University of Washington in Seattle, geologist there. And we've got callers I want to go to, one or two right here. Jeff in Rocky Hill, Connecticut. Jeff, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I went to UC Santa Barbara, and a number of years ago, when we were first married, I lived in a small little village just south of Santa Barbara called La Conchita.
Yeah.
And it was like a little beach community, and it had been there for like 50 years. We rented a little beach house. And then eventually after I had graduated, we'd moved away and lived in Los Angeles. And I think now it's been about 15 years ago that the whole mountain in back of that came loose, very similar to what happened in Washington, but on a much, much smaller scale. And unfortunately, there was one family that was killed in that, but it was without warning. We used to hike up that mountain. We used to ride bikes up, so it wasn't even that steep. And it came down and just slid and caught everybody totally by surprise.
Out of nowhere, and
warning.
Yeah, and a family gone. Jeff, I appreciate your call. David Montgomery, we've seen again and again these reports out of California. I mean, the real risk area of the country is Washington, I guess parts of Oregon, down into California, where the risk of mudslide is greatest.
Well, there's landslides are a hazard also in the Appalachians and the Rocky Mountains. Steep terrain is landslide prone. Landslides are a natural process that shapes topography. Mm-hmm. And the western seaboard is very geologically dynamic. There's a lot of steep slopes out here, and there are conditions like at the Oso site where a river has cut down into glacial deposits that makes that particular slope so unstable, or where in California, for example, where the ocean has undermined coastal bluffs. Yes, we have a higher degree of landslide hazard on the West Coast than in much of the country. But the style of landsliding that can happen in different places can be very different. I use the La Conchita landslide in my introductory geomorphology class that mm-hmm. I teach at the University of Washington mm-hmm. as an example of a large slump that could behave exactly like your caller described it as. And I think what this highlights is that, you know, for a huge event that can strike without warning and move rapidly to destroy the things downslope, the only realistic way to absolutely mitigate the hazard is to not have people in harm's way.
Tough when you've got so many people. Of course, on the West Coast, they're often fast, as you suggest. You've got others that are slow. I'm reading here what up in Keene, New York, on the slopes of Little Porter Mountain in the Adirondacks, an 82-acre landslide in 2001 that was more of a slow creep landslide. But if you've got sewerage and public infrastructure there, private for that matter, all it takes is a few inches to really wreck things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then a lot of really big landslides do move really slowly. They're a style called earth flows. There's stretches of Highway 1 in California that construction crews are virtually permanently located on to keep fixing the highway as the earth moves out from under it. understanding the nature of the hazards of earth movement is really the first step to be able to translate into hazard reduction and actually being able to ensure that, that people are not at risk and that, that infrastructure can be designed in ways that perhaps minimize that. If we don't understand how the surface of the earth works, we can't really take the first steps even to mitigate hazards.
Yeah. David Montgomery, stand by in Seattle if you would. I want to go to Vancouver, Washington right now. And Daniel Miller, you described Daniel's early warning to us a few minutes ago. In 1999, he reported, co-authored with his wife, warning of the potential for a large catastrophic failure on exactly this large hillside in Oso, Washington. He's a geologist at Earth Systems Institute and joins us right now from Washington State. Daniel Miller, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. You're welcome.
You must have felt a little sick through this last week as you saw your warning actually come to pass, Daniel.
Yes, that's true.
Was it clear to you? I mean, you know, were you saying this is going to happen? This is going to happen in a year, in 2 years? Or was this a broad general warning that nobody could really have responded to? You know, lots of bad things could happen. We could be hit by an asteroid.
Well, I think the latter is more correct. You know, the study that we did in which we reported the potential for failure of a very large volume of material was done to identify strategies for reducing sediment inputs from the landslide into the river. The focus was not on identifying hazards downslope. The focus was on improving water quality.
And yet you foresaw the possibility of a large catastrophic failure here.
That's correct.
Why was that so obvious to you as a geologist?
Well, in this case, you know, one of the things we wanted to do was to identify, to quantify the amount of sediment that could move into the river. So we used slope stability models to estimate where instability could occur and the volume of material that would be mobilized. Those models suggested that there was a large volume of material that extended way up into that plateau at the top called Whitman Bench that could potentially be mobilized.
You must have done a lot of work, and David as well, in the Northwest over the years. Was this a very rare combination of circumstances that led to this level of threat, or are there many mountain and hillsides with this kind of threat, Daniel Miller?
In Washington State, given the conditions that Dr. Montgomery had already described, I think there are many locations where this is a possibility.
I assume, David Montgomery, most of them don't have towns at their base, or do they?
Well, there's a lot of large deep-seated landslides in the region, and the answer to that is that it depends. There's some very large ones, even within the city of Seattle on the coast of Puget Sound, that we don't think tend to move quite as rapidly as this one, although a piece of the bluff on Whidbey Island failed catastrophically. I believe it was even just last year. We need to really have a new look at the landslide hazards in this region with the benefit of the very high-resolution topographic data we now have, which clearly shows sort of even larger failures of, I believe, the style like the one that happened at Oso within that same valley. We have a new pair of glasses for looking at these hazards and revisiting it to try and actually take the kind of insight that Dan had to that particular site and look at those conditions around the region. But, of course, we can't just look at the topography. We need to understand the geology that's actually within the slopes as well. And the conditions at this site really made the Hazel landslide, or the one that failed tragically, as a particularly bad actor.
There's topography. There's geology. There's also meteorology. You know, you had a weather station in the hills above this slide zone recording 24 inches of rain in the month. Now, it's a rainy time of year. Washington State gets plenty of rain, in this area. People are thinking a lot these days, Daniel Miller, about extreme weather. And, you know, if we just got another inch or two per year, I don't know how fragile these slide-prone areas might be. But if a particular part of the country saw an uptick over time of some margin, more rain, could it set loose a bunch of hillsides that have been fairly stable in the past?
That seems like a definite possibility.
David Montgomery, we had a report out of the UN just this last week linking extreme weather events of the last year to climate change. I mean, we're just kind of trying to keep our eye on the ball here. If we have an era of more extreme weather in front of us, could we have a more volatile sort of planet surface here in a lot of these slide-prone areas?
Well, you know, certainly if we get more rainfall and if we get more extreme weather, then you could expect the hazard for landsliding to go up. It's a stretch to sort of tie a particular event like this one to,
of course,
to global change or to global climate change in the same way that it's difficult to connect any particular weather event to a change in the climate. That those kind of connections could be only we'll learn of them as they unfold. But the simple answer to your question of if we get more extreme rainfall, should we expect to see more landsliding? Well, the simple answer to that is yes.
And what does that mean to your mind, Daniel Miller? I don't know if you think about human habitation. You're a geologist, but should that change where we live? We've got a lot of areas in your state and beyond where this could be a factor. Or, you know, is this just like lots of people live in areas that have risk factors of one kind or another associated with them?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer. I think it's important that we have changes in the level of risk, that people are aware of that. But that requires, of course, that we determine what those changes are, that we inform people about that, and that they trust the information that we're giving them.
Yeah. Let's go to Heather, calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Heather, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Someone on the lines that you were just speaking about, and earlier you were talking about the ethics of allowing these people to build their homes where they did, in that mudslide zone. I'm from Washington State, but from the east side, and it's very different. And actually, when I was growing up, wildfires and were the issue.
Right.
And that we're seeing that all over the country, especially on the West Coast. Wildfires every single year.
Yep.
People
the Rockies,
are building their homes in areas where wildfires, you know, are very likely going to happen. I live in South Carolina now, but we're about to move to Florida into a hurricane zone where flooding is very, you know what's going to happen.
So what do you take from all that, Heather? Where are you taking us here?
Just that I think that we need to be careful in vilifying the county in terms of allowing the people to build their homes there. I mean, we're encroaching on land all over the country, including areas that we know are high risk, and we're making those choices. And then when you also include, you know, climate change, where all of these extreme weather events are happening, that just ups it even more. I just think the discussion, at least earlier, in terms of, you know, wondering if the county did everything they could, and especially, I know someone had mentioned allowing them to build their homes there. I don't know that that's necessarily fair, and especially when it's happening everywhere else, and like I said, wildfire.
No, Heather, we take the point, and I'm glad you raise it that way. It's so interesting. I mean, you heard David earlier. We had a caller saying we need a criminal investigation here, the permitting authorities. The other end of that spectrum, Heather's pointing out that an obvious fact that millions and millions of Americans, just for starters, live in areas with one kind of threat or another. Where on that spectrum do you, as a geologist, look at human habitation up against your geology, David? Is it responsible to have people building and living in a place like Oso? If it's not, how do we act on that?
You know, I think that at the heart of the question of the caller is there's a very good point, in the sense that as people build out into areas that have higher geological activity or higher hazards, they can only make informed choices if we know what those hazards actually are, and they get communicated to the people who are in a position to make the choice of what kind of a risk is an acceptable risk.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to deal with land use on a local level in this country in terms of regulation and permitting. And so there's no sort of uniform standard as to what is defined as where we will allow people to build in terms of that level of risk. And you know, frankly, that's not a scientific decision. That's a social and political decision about where those kinds of risks are acceptable for people to run or
I'm reading here about – oh, I'm sorry. Please, go ahead.
I was going to say that what's absolutely critical to making those kind of evaluations as a society is to accurately understand what are the risks, where are the risks higher? Where are they lower? What really are the probabilities of high magnitude, low frequency events like a catastrophic landslide, and get that information into the hands of both decision makers and also the people who might potentially be influenced by those kinds of activities. There's no website you can go to, for example, like Zillow for real estate prices, where you can say, well, what are the geologic hazards of this piece of land I'm thinking of buying?
Technically, could we do it? I'm reading here about a new Japanese satellite that's going to go up, which will measure movements all the time in the Earth's surface, a U.S.-India project, which will do that in even more detail. Do we have really good risk maps that could be available so at least people know? Will those get better as these satellites give us more data?
I think that what I'm perfectly comfortable saying is that there's an awful lot that could be done to try and actually provide information like that out to the general public, but it takes resources and people to actually try and put those kind of things together. And what you'd want would be a regional strategy to actually evaluate those hazards and then follow through on getting the information into formats that people can actually use.
Connecting the dots. If we want to know and are willing to invest in learning. If we don't, sooner or later, I guess it gets laid out for us anyway. Tragic to think of all those rescue and recovery, I guess, mainly now, people working on that vast slide in Oso, Washington today. I want to thank the two of you very much for being with us. Daniel Miller with Earth Systems Institute joining us from Vancouver, Washington, geologist there. Daniel Miller, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
And David Montgomery, professor of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. David, you're terrific. Thank you for your insights today.
Great. Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.